Chapter 8. An Emerging South Korea. War, Authoritarianism, and Economic Development. An Unpromising Start. South Korea under Syngman Rhee. When New York Times reporter A.M. Rosenthal visited South Korea in early 1961 for a series on the country, he found it still mired in poverty, unemployment, corruption, and political instability. Despite being one of the world's largest recipients of U.S. aid, it had managed to achieve only a modest recovery from the destruction of the Korean War that had ended nigh 8 years earlier. So grim did he find the prospects for the country's future that at the end of the series he recommended mass emigration from the crowded country and called for generous assistance from the West, which he thought would be needed for generations. Rosenthal's observations were typical of outsiders, who generally came away with bleak assessments of South Korea's prospects. Yet he wrote his series of reports on the eve of one of the most rapid periods of sustained economic growth ever seen. In a little more than a generation, the country would become a wealthy democratic nation, noted for its technological sophistication. Indeed, South Korea's transformation was often labeled a miracle. Yet it was no miracle, for the people who endured the many failures, frustrations, and hardships on the road to building a modern, developed nation. In fact, the first years of South Korea, from 1945 to the early 1960s, were characterized by mass displacement, hunger, war, and frustrated hopes for a reunited fatherland. The 1960s and 1970s saw rapid industrial growth under the authoritarian regime of Park Chung-hee, but growth was achieved at the cost of political repression, harsh working conditions, and often wrenching social change, while the threat of renewed conflict remained ever-present. South Korea in the 1950s was hardly a very promising society. Already poor, it had suffered a level of destruction that, while not as great as that experienced by the North, was still appalling. Millions had been dislocated during the war, thousands of homes and buildings destroyed. Almost every family had lost someone during the war. They'd either been killed or marched off to the North. Over this devastation presided the government of President Syngman Rhee. It was authoritarian, corrupt, and seemingly incompetent. Rhee himself, in his late 70s at the end of the Korean War, was energetic, intelligent, and politically shrewd, but primarily interested in maintaining his position as president and lacking any vision of how to pull his nation out of poverty. His Liberal Party was mainly an instrument to keep him and his supporters in power. It had no real ideology or program for development. In contrast to North Korea, the economy under his direction made only a modest recovery. Once an agricultural breadbasket, South Korea now relied on American food aid, exporting almost nothing. Much of its economy was based on U.S. aid, its chief source of foreign exchange, and Rhee's administration skimmed off as much of this as possible for its own purposes. There was a small business sector, but it worked closely with the Liberal Party. The case of Lee Pyeong-chul was illustrative. Rhee's government would hoard U.S. aid dollars, then it would provide Lee with a license to exchange the overvalued official currency, the won, for those dollars. Lee would use the money to buy sugar, which his number one sugar company would then sell at an enormous profit, a percentage of which would go to the Liberal Party. In this way, he became Korea's richest man, and he was only one of a number of business leaders to operate in this cycle of buying cheap dollars and recycling some of the profits to the ruling party. Thus, the small business sector was not only unproductive, but it was tarnished by its ties to a corrupt and increasingly discredited regime. One way out of the poverty would have been to reestablish ties with Japan. This made perfect sense to the Americans, who wanted Seoul to establish diplomatic relations with Tokyo. Then it could sell rice, seaweed, and seafood to the Japanese in return for manufactured goods, rather than relying on aid money for almost all its foreign exchange. But Rhee, who was almost pathologically anti-Japanese, would have none of it. He refused to even normalize diplomatic relations with Tokyo. Instead, from time to time, he seized Japanese fishing boats just to stir up tension, claiming the former colonial rulers were still violating the country's sovereignty. This frustrated the Americans. Yet Rhee was not just being a difficult old man. He and many Koreans were dead set against reverting back to the colonial times when Korea functioned as a source of cheap food for an industrial, dominant Japan. On paper, the country was democratic, with free elections and opposition parties, but Rhee and his Liberal Party made full use of the government apparatus to intimidate voters and manipulate the election procedures. Rural voters were sometimes simply brought to the polls by local officials and told who to vote for. Still, the party was only able to maintain a bare majority in the 1954 National Assembly elections. The new assembly then voted to change the constitution so Rhee could run for a third term in 1956, which of course he did. He was challenged by the Democratic Party, which had been created in 1955 by a merger of smaller opposition parties. This new party, dominated by conservatives, offered not a radical alternative vision, but simply a cleaner, more competent government. The Democratic Party nominated Shin Ikui, another aging political veteran, to run against Rhee. However, Shin, who had serious health problems, died weeks before the elections. The only other choice for voters was a more left-leaning third-party candidate, Chobonkam, a socialist who had been the principal architect of the country's recent land reform. Rhee won easily, but about a third of the voters, mostly in urban areas, voted for Cho. After the election, Rhee had Cho arrested on charges of treason and executed. Even so, the trends did not look good for Rhee. The urban and middle classes, fed up with his corruption and incompetence, were turning against him, and these were the groups that were growing as education and urbanization expanded. In 1960, Rhee ran again, despite being 85 years old. The Democratic Party, which seemed to have learned nothing from its earlier experience, nominated another older conservative with health problems, Cho Pyong-oh, who also died just before the election. There was no foul play involved with either candidate's death, just extraordinarily poor choices and bad luck for the party. The focus of the election then turned on the competitive race for vice president, a race that took on great significance because few expected the aging president, who now had no opposition, to live out his 4-year term. The Democratic candidate was a mild-mannered Catholic, Chung Myon, who faced Liberal Party candidate Lee Ki-bung. He had been adopted by the childless Rhee and his wife as their son, but was wildly unpopular. This time the government took no chances and blatantly manipulated the election results so that the extremely unpopular Lee won by an enormous landslide. No one believed his election was legitimate. This proved too much for the public. Anti-government demonstrations broke out, first in the southern port city of Masan, and then throughout the country. When on April 19, 1960, tens of thousands of students paraded in the streets of Seoul toward the presidential mansion, the police fired on them, killing many. When the demonstrations continued over the following days, the military commander in Seoul refused to use force to stop them, and Rhee was finished. He resigned under U.S. pressure, and the Americans spirited him away to exile in his former home of Hawaii. Lee Ki-bung and his wife committed suicide. The overthrow of Rhee was followed by an experiment in democracy, which unfortunately did not go well. From 1960 to 1961, South Korea tried a parliamentary system with the ruling Democratic Party Prime Minister Chung Myon. Chung and many members of his cabinet were sincere believers in a Western-style democracy and made plans for a comprehensive program of economic development. Had there been time, perhaps they would have succeeded in guiding the country out of poverty. During their brief administration, however, all the pent-up frustrations of ordinary citizens came to the fore. Workers organized real unions, not the government-controlled official ones. Students organized almost daily demonstrations. School teachers went on strike. Seoul was often paralyzed by strikes and protests. Then there was North Korea, which, seeing an opportunity, sent feelers out to the protesters calling for a peaceful reunification. When a group of students decided to meet their northern counterparts at Panmunjom on the DMZ, it alarmed conservative anti-communist elements. The military, disgusted with civilian incompetence and concerned about national security, carried out a coup under General Park Chung-hee. Looking back, it is easy to dismiss this sad decade. But several positive developments did take place that laid the foundations for South Korea's economic miracle. One major change was the land reform. On the eve of the Korean War, the Ri regime had finally capitulated to peasant demands, U.S. pressure, and the fear of communist revolution, and carried out a land reform. The process, which was completed over the next several years, limited landholding to just 7.5 acres, 3 hectares. Unlike in the north, landowners were compensated by farmers, who had to make payments over a number of years. But high inflation quickly reduced these to nominal amounts. This land reform also differed from the north's in that the land was not taken away by the state. Rather, it turned the country's farmers into small agricultural entrepreneurs. Many former landlords took their modest compensation and invested it in educational foundations. In this way, land reform contributed to perhaps the most fundamental change the country experienced at this time, the expansion of education. From the late 1940s to 1961, primary school attendance tripled to become nearly universal for all boys and girls. Enrollment in secondary schools increased by a factor of 8, and in higher education by a factor of 10. Adult literacy campaigns taught millions how to read and write, while teacher training programs enabled the schools to maintain a fairly high level of instruction, even during rapid expansion. As a result, Korea in 1961 may have been extremely poor, but it had the best educated population of any very poor country. At the same time, a steady stream of South Koreans was entering the U.S. for advanced training, returning with prestigious degrees and creating a core of competent technocrats. By the end of the 1950s, these technocrats were already meeting and drawing up long-range development plans, although they had not yet been implemented when the military took over. Given the fundamental changes that were underway, would the civilians who were trying to create a democratic system in 1961 have succeeded in bringing about the economic miracle? Could South Koreans have been spared the brutality and oppression of the military dictatorship that frog-marched the country into an industrialized society and still have become prosperous? Of course, we will never know. Park Chung-hee's forced march to economic development. Park Chung-hee, the new leader of the ROK, was the youngest of 7 children from a poor peasant family in Gyeongsang, a region of southeast Korea that was the homeland of the ancient Silla state. A bright pupil, he won a competitive scholarship in a teacher training institution and became a schoolteacher. Although he only taught for 3 years, there remained something of the stern schoolmaster about him. Park graduated from the Manjukuo Military Academy in 1944 and was commissioned as a second lieutenant in the Japanese Imperial Army. After the war, he served in the ROK Army, but was implicated in the Yeosu Rebellion. He barely escaped execution and was dismissed. His brother was involved in leftist politics, but it is not clear whether Park flirted with communism. When the Korean War broke out, he was reinstated and served with distinction. Park was a small, slender man, not very physically imposing or charismatic. However, he had a reputation for being intelligent, well-disciplined, and uncorrupt, and he was well-respected by younger officers. He would dominate the country for the next 18 years. For Park, especially, economic development was the most urgent task. There were several reasons for this. One was the humiliation of being so dependent on the U.S., which supplied over half the government's revenue. As Park stated it, the U.S. had a 52% share in the state, which meant that the ROK could hardly call itself an independent country. At the same time, much of the desire to find a path to economic development was driven by the rivalry with North Korea. With Pyongyang's industrialization roaring ahead, the task seemed urgent. Not only was it a military threat, but the stagnation of the South as the North surged ahead in the march to progress only undermined Seoul's claim to be the true representative of the Korean nation. Furthermore, South Korea wanted to emulate Japan. Then there was the poverty that pervaded the nation. Pak, who had spent a year in the U.S. for military training, was only too aware of the sad plight of his country, which was among the poorest in the world. Its per capita income was about the same as Haiti's. The streets of Seoul were filled with beggars and children selling gum. Much of the countryside was at the subsistence level, with homes lacking electricity or running water, connected to cities and towns by rough, unpaved roads winding through the mountains. There were few jobs, even for the growing number of secondary school and university graduates. The task of pulling the country out of poverty seemed so daunting that even foreign aid advisors tended to be rather pessimistic about the country's prospects. Yet Pak was determined to make it happen. Pak and most of the other military leaders were clear about where they wanted to go, but unsure how to get there. Their advantage was that they were pragmatic, flexible, and willing to take advice. After an initial period of mixed and confusing policies, the junta followed a development path that copied Japan's state-led model, but with the South Korean state playing an even bigger role in supervising the economy. Its first big economic move was to nationalize the banks and cancel all rural debt. With control of the nation's lending, it could direct money toward the investments it saw as productive. The junta then drew up a 5-year economic development plan for 1962 to 1966 that directed state efforts toward specific economic targets. At first, leading members of the business community were charged with corruption and arrested or fined. Early on, however, the junta realized that they needed the entrepreneurial skills of the country's business community. Charges against the top 24 businessmen were dropped after they pledged to donate all of their property to the state if it was needed for national reconstruction. Lee Pyeongchul, who was hiding in Japan, the very symbol of all that the military men had despised about the old regime, was allowed to return. The junta created the Promotional Committee for Economic Reconstruction with Lee as the chair, and a new partnership between the business community and the state was forged. This one proved highly productive. The 5-year plan was a huge success. Its target was 7.1% economic growth based on light industry, which some foreign advisors had considered a bit too optimistic. In fact, however, growth over the next 5 years averaged almost 9%. Exports grew by 29% a year and manufacturing by 5% a year. South Korea had only one resource, cheap labor, and this was utilized for low-cost, labor-intensive industries, textiles, footwear, wigs. South Korea opened itself to foreign investment, which supplied the capital and technology it needed to industrialize. Incentives were offered to encourage foreign investment. Backers could benefit from low taxes, the ease of getting the profits out of the country, and a government willing to provide the infrastructure and other assistance they needed. Korean workers were cheap and willing to work long hours, and if they caused trouble, the government would crack down on them. South Korea was careful to include technology transfer agreements linking local firms with foreign ones. In this way, Kia and Hyundai made car parts for Detroit while simultaneously learning how to make the cars that would compete with it. The state also stepped up technical education and training, creating the Korean Institute for Science and Technology in 1966 and staffing it with PhDs in science and engineering from some of the best schools in the world. Looking for foreign investors, Pak turned to Japan. In the 1960s and 1970s, the Japanese needed places to invest their vast profits, as well as somewhere to offshore their manufacturing as labor costs rose. There was South Korea, right next door, sharing the same time zone with a business community that in most cases could speak their language. South Korea needed capital and technical know-how, so it was a natural match. There was a problem, however. Lingering hatred prevented Seoul from opening up diplomatic relations, and any attempt to do so would raise accusations of treason. Pak himself was compromised by his past service in the Imperial Army, and there were genuine fears that little South Korea could find itself becoming a de facto economic dependency of Japan. Nonetheless, Pak ignored the massive demonstrations against normalizing relations and signed the peace treaty in 1965. Tokyo offered a modest $800 million in reparations, but the treaty resulted in a flood of Japanese investments. In the 1970s, the Pak regime focused more attention on rural development and on shifting from light to heavy industry. The transformation of the countryside came swiftly and rather heavy-handedly. In 1971, Pak launched the New Village Movement, which mobilized the rural population in an effort at forced modernization. Farmers were ordered to remove their picturesque, but to Pak's mind, backward, thatched roofs for tile ones. Poor families had to settle for corrugated metal roofs. Family planning programs were vigorously carried out to bring down the birth rate. Industrial development refocused from textiles to heavy and chemical industries. Despite the skepticism of many American advisors, the shift to heavy industry was mostly successful. By the 1980s, South Korea was becoming one of the world's largest exporters of steel and its second largest shipbuilder. The symbol of its success was the enormous Pohang Iron and Steel Complex, the largest and most modern of its kind, and also a rarity, being a profitable state-owned and managed enterprise, although it was eventually privatized. From Lucky Strike to LG, the rise of South Korea's Chaepol. A signature feature of South Korea's economic development was that it centered around large Chaepol. Derived from the Japanese term zaibatsu, the Chaepol were family-owned conglomerates. Some became enormous in size. Since the state owned the banks, it could lend money on generous terms to companies that it favored. It also gave them all kinds of special preferential treatment, such as exemptions from import duties on capital goods and special rates on utilities and railroads, both of which the state also owned. Furthermore, the state-owned banks would lend capital at favorable rates. An important element of this relationship, and the reason it worked, was that favored businesses had to prove themselves through performance. State aid went to the most efficient ones. The Chaepol, it is worth pointing out, were not the products of the state. They were the creations of dynamic, talented entrepreneurs, many of whom predated the Pak era. It was the Pak regime's support that allowed them to flourish, and some grew to be among the world's largest privately owned companies. Who were these talented entrepreneurs? One of the oldest was Guin Hoi, who in 1947 founded the Lucky Chemical Company, which became the country's largest toothpaste manufacturer. The name Lucky was popularized by American Lucky Strike cigarettes, a hot black market item in Korea. One of the many products from the U.S. military's PX supply stores that somehow found their way to street vendors. Pak's government, attracted to Koo's business acumen, lent him money for an export item, electric fans made under the label Gold Star, Kumsong in Korean. Koo now called his company Lucky Gold Star. Koo passed away in 1969, just as Gold Star was taking off. His family continued to expand the company, which was renamed LG in 1995 and became one of the world's largest manufacturers of consumer electronics. Another early entrepreneur, Kim Sung-kon, founded the Sung-yong Twin Dragons Textile Company in 1939. In the 1950s, he got involved in an import license agreement with the Ri government to import cement. Despite his connections with the Ri regime, he turned out to be a resourceful, go-getting entrepreneur. With government support, he branched out into construction, trading, and automobile production. Sang-yong became one of the largest of the Chaepol. Few Chaepol founders could match Chung Chu-young for energy, ambition, and entrepreneurial skill. A man from a humble rural background in Kwangwon province in what later became North Korea, Chung had gotten his start back in the colonial time. Having little taste for farming, he stole a cow, sold it, and went to Seoul, where he started an auto repair business. During the Korean War, he did contract work for the U.S. and ROK armies. When the Pak regime gave him a contract to build a bridge over the Han River, Chung completed it ahead of schedule in 1965. The government, duly impressed, gave him all kinds of additional construction contracts. Chung developed a reputation for completing projects with lightning speed and built many facilities in Vietnam for the American and Korean forces. In the 1970s, he won many lucrative contracts in newly rich oil-exporting countries, which were anxious to convert their new oil wealth into visible infrastructure as quickly as possible. Chung famously got into shipbuilding by signing a contract with a shipping company to build vessels. He then started a dockyard from scratch and built the ships on time. When the government decided to develop an auto industry, Chung's Hyundai, the Korean word for modern car company, was born. Then there was Lee Byung-chul, the notorious crony capitalist who flourished under the Rhee regime. He differed from Chung in that he came from a wealthy Yangpan background, but was more attracted to industry than landowning. Lee started the Samsung Three Stars Company in the 1960s. Starting in the late 1960s, he focused on electronics, for which his company became internationally known. But he got into other things as well, from appliances to automobiles. Although the Chepol had modern-looking corporate structures and eventually developed state-of-the-art research labs and training centers, they remained family businesses. The top managerial positions were almost always held by family members. Chung Ju-young's vast Hyundai group was run by his eight sons, the Eight Princes, as they were known. Stocks might be publicly traded, but the family always kept a controlling share. Samsung, for example, became the world's largest family-owned enterprise in the 21st century. The next managerial tier was run by high school and college classmates of the founder and his son, followed by those from the same hometown. Thus, there was something very traditionally Korean about these modern enterprises. Moon villages and flyers, the social cost of industrialization. While Pak and the Chapol heads are often praised for their part in South Korea's economic development, it was done at great cost. Workers went home to slums known as moon villages, which often sprang up on the hillsides of cities. Working conditions were often horrible. Korean workers put in longer hours than those in any other industrial country, averaging nearly 55 hours a week in the 1980s, and many worked far longer. This was more than the notoriously workaholic Japanese worker. 12-hour days were common, and the 6-hour work week was the norm, with many men and women receiving only every other Sunday off. Scant regard was given to safety, and South Korean industries had among the world's worst safety records. Tired workers from shipyards became flyers as they fell to their deaths from the high scaffolding. Construction workers, being driven to complete projects ahead of schedule, suffered terribly frequent accidents. In the 1970s, a Korean was 15 times more likely to be injured at work than his Japanese counterpart. Especially appalling were the conditions under which women, who made up about a third of the labor force, especially in the garment industry, lived. Female factory workers, mostly country girls earning money to send home to their families, worked in dingy, noisy sweatshops. They were housed in beehives, grim company buildings so nicknamed for their warrens of tiny rooms. Often they were locked in at night. Many had short hair, since they cut it periodically to sell for wigs. Korean industrialists used Confucian terminology of paternalism, loyalty, and harmony to create a sense of the company as a big family. Management was the benevolent parent figure looking out for the workers, who repaid this generosity with loyalty and hard work. The workers didn't buy it, though. Labor unrest was common, as were attempts to form independent labor unions. In theory, workers were represented by Korean Federation of Trade Unions, a government-controlled institution created to keep control of labor, but they despised it. Harmony was maintained with the help of riot police, who were called in, not infrequently, to break strikes and demonstrations. companies hired their own gangs of thugs to beat up and intimidate troublesome employees. Initially, workers had the legal right to collective bargaining and collective action, even if in practice it was met with brutal retaliation. But in 1971, the state suspended this right, making any kind of labor protest cause for police intervention. Employers also hired their own corps of enforcers to beat up labor organizers. Government and company measures were effective enough to give the illusion to foreign investors that Koreans were hardworking, which they were, and happy to toil endlessly for modest wages, which they were not. The long hours and docile nature of the labor force was a selling point that was promoted by the state, employers, and foreign investors. All this was too much for young labor activist Chung Dae-il, a worker in the Pyeonghwa market, a hideous block-long four-story complex of small garment factories and clothing shops employing 20,000 workers. He witnessed workers suffering from tuberculosis and respiratory ailments from laboring in cramped workshops lacking proper ventilation. Workers were given amphetamines to keep them awake during the long hours they put in. He sent complaints to government officials about the worst abuses he saw, only to be told he was being unpatriotic. Frustrated, one day he set himself on fire and went running through the streets of downtown Seoul, shouting, "We are not machines," enforce the labor code, before dying. Chun's actions were not anomalous. Violent labor protests broke out occasionally. Women took part in or even initiated some of these, such as the protest at the Donggi Textile Company in 1972, and another at the YH Trading Company in Busan in 1979. But under PAC, state repression and corporate thuggery largely succeeded in containing labor unrest. Near dictatorship, the authoritarian system of Park Chung-hee. Park Chung-hee was right about South Korea not being fully independent. It still relied on U.S. aid and protection, and so Park was forced to comply with American pressure to restore the government to civilian rule. He did this by taking off his military uniform, donning a suit and tie, and running for president in 1963 as the head of his own Democratic Republican Party. The election was at least partially fair, and he legitimately won, while his party captured control of the National Assembly. It was not a landslide, and there was real opposition, but not enough to keep him and his party from power. He was re-elected in 1967, and in 1969 the National Assembly used rather dubious methods to amend the Constitution so he could run for a third term. By 1971, Park was pretty confident that his system was doing well, and that he had the grateful support of his people. Evidence of growing prosperity was everywhere. Even the ordinary people were seeing their living standards improve, and the future looked bright. But in spite of the decade of spectacular economic expansion, there was more opposition to him than he seemed to have realized. When he ran for a third term, his main opponent was a young lawyer from Cholla province in the southwest named Kim Dae-chung. Kim, who like Park was a self-made man from humble origins, proved a good campaigner, and did surprisingly well, even though all the power and patronage of the state was against him. He was outspoken in his criticism of the authoritarian nature of the regime and the exploitation of labor. Although Park won 51% to 44%, the closeness of the election shocked him. Not only had he failed to win in a landslide, as he expected, but he had not carried the cities. A bad sign for a rapidly urbanizing society. In fact, he may not have won the popular vote at all, since there was a lot of voter manipulation in the rural areas. Park did well among farmers, the elderly, and anti-communist conservatives, but fared badly among the young, the educated, and the rising middle class, all the demographic groups that were likely to dominate the future. In addition to weakening domestic support, there were other signs of trouble. The U.S. was placing protectionist pressure against South Korean textiles, the country's biggest export. More worrisome, in the early 1970s, the United States was disengaging from its commitment to defend South Vietnam, and there was concern that a withdrawal from South Korea would be next. Furthermore, in 1972, Nixon visited North Korea's ally, China. Then there was uncertainty over where the talks with North Korea that took place in 1972 were leading. Worried about internal opposition and labor unrest, feeling internationally insecure, and wanting to strengthen his hand in negotiating with Pyongyang, Park decided to give up the game of playing at a semi-democracy and go for more absolute power. On October 17, 1972, he proclaimed martial law. He dissolved the National Assembly, banned all political parties, placed restrictions on free speech, and expanded the authority of police to arrest subversive elements. He had a new constitution written, known as the Yushin Revitalization Constitution. This allowed for a rather toothless National Assembly and gave the president near dictatorial powers. Unwilling to risk another direct election, he was to be elected by the National Unification Board, a body that he appointed, which meant that Park essentially elected himself. Not surprisingly, he won. Not content with his new constitution, Park issued a series of emergency decrees that further strengthened his authority. The most notorious was Emergency Measure No. 9 in 1975, which made any criticism of the president a crime. A wave of political repression placed many politicians, writers, artists, intellectuals, and journalists in jail. Dissidents living abroad were kidnapped by the Korean Central Intelligence Agency, KCIA, and brought back home to be imprisoned. The KCIA itself was a vast secret police organization which had nearly a million informants. A notorious incident involving the KCIA was its abduction of Kim Dae-jung. Park sought revenge against his former political opponent, who had fled to the U.S. and secured a position at Harvard. While Kim was visiting Tokyo, Park had his agents abduct him from his hotel room. They placed him in a boat in the open sea, tied and blindfolded him, and prepared to dump him into the ocean. His aides, suspecting Park was behind Kim's sudden disappearance, alerted Washington. Realizing that he had to act quickly, a resourceful American diplomat contacted the office of President Park and pretended to be speaking on behalf of the U.S. president as he demanded Kim's release. The bluff worked, and Park had Kim Dae-jung, still blindfolded, dumped on the street in front of his house in Korea. He then was allowed to return to the U.S. While Kim's high profile helped save him, other dissidents were less fortunate. Many revolutions. South Korea's society in rapid change. Under the years of military rule, South Korea became more urban, more literate, and more Christian. Cities swelled in size. In 1950, South Korea was an overwhelmingly rural society, but by the 1980s it had become a mostly urban one. The population of most rural areas began shrinking after 1960 as people left for the cities. All the older cities grew, and new ones emerged, such as the industrial cities of Masan and Gumi. Nothing, however, approached the size of Seoul, which grew into a megacity. From less than a million, it was approaching 8 million by the late 1980s, or about the size of New York or London. It was the country's leading industrial center, its cultural and entertainment center, and its educational center. All the top universities were located there, while also being, of course, the seat of government. So central was Seoul to the country that all trains either were labeled as going up, toward it, or down, away from it. The speed of South Korea's urbanization was matched by the growth in literacy rates. Every child went to school, and almost all graduated. This is particularly surprising because education wasn't cheap. Rather than pour scarce resources into schools, the state shifted much of the cost onto parents, who had to pay all sorts of fees even for so-called free public primary schools. And no matter how poor they were, almost all of them managed to come up with the money. Classes were enormous, with 100 students in a single classroom. Teachers sometimes taught two classes, one in the morning and another in the afternoon. After 1960, when primary education became universal, educational development focused on secondary schooling. Fewer than one in three young people matriculated into both middle and high school in the early 1960s, but by the late 1980s, over 90% did so. By that time, enrollment rates in schools at all levels were already approaching those of advanced nations like Japan, Western Europe, and the U.S. Extensive in-service training kept teaching competence high, and teacher training programs were continuously improved. If one went out at night in Seoul or any other city in South Korea in the 1980s, another major change in the country would become apparent in the lighted crosses, which were ubiquitous. South Korea was not only becoming more urban and literate, it was becoming more Christian. The growth of that religion after 1950 was phenomenal. Christianity had a long history in the country, but despite the early growth of Catholicism and the prominent role Protestant missionaries played in Korea in the late 19th and early 20th centuries by building churches, schools, hospitals, in 1945, only a small percentage of Koreans were Christian, and the majority of those were in the North, not the South. But then the religion took off. With their world shaken by the upheaval of the Korean War and the rapid industrialization and urbanization of society, Koreans were looking for something to provide them more certainty, meaning, and solace. Many found it in church. Furthermore, Christianity was associated with modernization and progress. By the late 1980s, nearly a third of South Koreans were Christian, many of them very fervent, making it the second most Christian nation in Asia after the Philippines, although Christians never outnumbered Buddhists. How did the South Korean economy grow so fast? Both Koreas experienced spectacular economic growth, but the patterns were very different. In the North, the economic boom happened a decade earlier, in the 1950s, and then slowed to a halt after 20 years. The South started in the 1960s and saw three decades of very rapid growth. Though it slowed down in the early 1990s, the economy continued to expand, and incomes continued to rise steadily for another generation. By the early 21st century, the country had become one of the first third-world countries to achieve first-world status. How did South Korea achieve this? Both Koreans and some foreigners attributed South Korea's economic success to its Confucian heritage. In the 1980s, the term Confucian ethos was bandied about as a key to understanding the rapid economic and social modernization of South Korea, as well as the rest of the four little tigers, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Singapore. This term suggests that the success of the four little tigers had deep cultural historical roots. Confucianism taught respect for education, hard work, willingness to delay gratification, thus encouraging a high savings rate, and government by merit. The last meant that states managed to attract talented civil servants, helping to make government both respected and effective in carrying out policies. None of this was necessarily wrong, but it did not explain why South Korea made so little progress before 1961, or why North Korea, with the same heritage, had such a different trajectory. In fact, many Koreans in both North and South cited their Confucian heritage, its veneration of tradition over innovation, its rigid ideas of hierarchy, its patriarchy, its contempt for technical and military skills, and its resistance to change, as an obstacle to progress. This view was shared by most Westerners before the 1960s. Given this state of affairs, it's not hard to understand why historians are wary of cultural explanations. Not only are they poor predictors of future trends, but they tend to simplify and stereotype too much and reinforce prejudices. Yet one cultural factor that worked to Korea's advantage was its respect for learning and the fact that it equated education with social status. This contributed to the drive for schooling that created a literate, numerate, and disciplined workforce. The school system might have been an unenviable pressure cooker, but it produced at minimum workers who could read instructions and at best workers who were competitive, quick to learn, and unafraid of challenges. Much of the credit for South Korea's economic miracle goes less to culture than policy. the government hit upon a successful formula: export-led growth that combined both state planning and promotion of industrial development with private ownership and the profit motive. Much like North Korea, the state could mobilize credit and resources for development, only these were implemented through the private market. Furthermore, the ROK state in directing development was pragmatic and flexible, rather than being tied to a rigid set of ideas, as the DPRK was. This flexibility, along with the focus on consumer products and the openness to foreign ideas, technologies, and investors, was a great advantage the North did not have. And while the North modeled itself, in part, on the historical dead ends of Stalinism and Maoism, the South looked to the more dynamic U.S., Western Europe, and especially Japan, for inspiration. Furthermore, there was one other factor it inherited from the miserable years of Japanese rule: a powerful authoritarian state that could impose policies overriding special interests. Another explanation is that South Korea had the help of the United States. American aid does not seem to have done much to promote growth, but American universities trained thousands of bright young people in administration, economics, education, science, and technology. The U.S. military presence acted as a guarantor of stability to reassure foreign investors, so that South Korea, while devoting considerable resources to the military, did not have to do so to the same degree as the North did. America's largely open market was also a great advantage, as it absorbed the bulk of the country's exports in its early years. Having Japan next door helped, too. It provided foreign investment, technical transfers, and perhaps most important of all, a model of how a culturally related people could build a prosperous modern society. Pak Chung-hee's last bad years. Pak Chung-hee's authoritarian tendencies were on full display in the 1970s, and he seemed to be making the country into an outright one-man rule police state. But his reliance on the United States was an obstacle. For all his talk of autonomy, he still depended on the U.S., not so much for aid anymore, but for its commitment to defending the country. Pak could never completely suppress all his opponents if he wanted to keep dealing with the U.S. For the most part, American officials disliked Pak. They found him difficult to work with and were often sympathetic to the opposition elements, so they were not averse to pressuring Pak to restrain himself from cracking down on them. Pak only alienated the U.S. further when he sent KCIA agents to kidnap and harass Korean Americans. Then there was the Koreagate scandal in 1975, in which Tung-sun Pak, a Korean businessman acting on behalf of the South Korean government, was involved in bribing U.S. congressmen. All this led to greater sympathy for the opposition. An even greater obstacle to Pak's complete consolidation of power was the resistance from the South Korean public, which never accepted his grab for near-dictatorial power. Throughout the 1970s, there were constant protests and demonstrations by political opposition groups, Christian organizations, labor activists, students, and intellectuals. These people endured dismissal from jobs, expulsion from school, beatings by government thugs, arrest, and torture, and yet still kept resisting his rule. In the late 1970s, unrest appeared to be growing despite the country's economic boom, and in the summer of 1979, brutal treatment of a group of women workers at a textile plant set off a new round of protests aimed at the Pak regime. At this time, an emerging political leader in the largely powerless National Assembly, Kim Yong-sam, called the president a dictator and was ousted from parliament. Opposition members of the assembly walked out, which intensified the protests. They were centered in the area around Busan, Kim's home base. As the situation became more chaotic, Pak's security chief, Kim Chae-kyu, suggested a compromise with the opposition. Pak, who was increasingly isolated and stubborn, instead indicated he was going to use the military to suppress the protesters. Kim Chae-kyu met with Pak for dinner at a KCIA compound near the Blue House. Pak was accompanied by a young college co-ed, a habit he had acquired since the assassination of his wife. At the dinner table, Kim shot Pak and his bodyguard, killing both instantly, and bringing an era to an end. As a side note, Kim Jae-kyu did not appear to have any real plan other than to kill Park. He seemed to be expected to be treated as a national savior for terminating the rule of a man who, for all his gifts and achievements, had acquired too much power and hung on for too long. Instead, he was arrested and executed. Park had so dominated South Korea that his death created a crisis, but it was also an opportunity for a more open society. From late 1979 through May of 1980, South Korea went through a brief Seoul Spring, while a caretaker government led by President Choi Kyu-ha, a professional bureaucrat who had served as Park's vice president, presided over the country. Politicians, journalists, intellectuals, and students lobbied for a new, more democratic constitution and debated over its contents. Kim Dae-jung and Kim Yong-sam emerged as the two major leaders at this time. But even as the public enjoyed its new freedom of expression, the military still held real power. In Korea, classmate bonds are strong and last a lifetime. The 8th graduating class of the Korean Military Academy had formed a clique that put Park in power. The 11th class put his successor, 2-star General Chun Doo-hwan, into power. On the night of December 12th, Chun and his classmates seized control of the army. Unlike Park's coup, it was not bloodless. There was an exchange of fire as the plotters attempted to arrest much of the high command. Some fled to the nearby U.S. military compound. After gaining control of the army, the new military group took control of the government step by step. In mid-May, Chun seized full command of the government, banning all demonstrations, labor strikes, and political activity. A number of leading opposition politicians were arrested, including Kim Dae-jung. Chun was now the new military leader of South Korea. Kim Dae-jung's home area of Chola, in the southwest, had been a stronghold of the opposition to Park. Once part of ancient Pyeongche, this region was neglected by Park in favor of his home region, which became the industrial heartland of the country. Chola, once a prosperous agricultural area, was now the poorest part of the country, with the least developed infrastructure and the fewest modern industries. The announcement of the arrest of the local hero resulted in a spontaneous uprising in the main urban center of South Chola Province, Gwangju. Students, joined by ordinary citizens, seized control of some armories and took over the city. For nearly 10 days, Gwangju was the center of the opposition, until Chun sent paratroopers into the city and slaughtered the poorly armed protesters. Officially, 200 were killed, but the real figure was much higher. The shocking Gwangju incident was not forgotten, and from the beginning of his government, Chun Doo-hwan was deeply resented, even hated, by many South Koreans. Nonetheless, he went on to write a new constitution, and after disqualifying almost everyone else, he ran for president. Underground satirists reported that he was considering entering his dog in the race so he would have an opponent, but was afraid he might lose. Choosing not to take such a chance, he ran uncontested and was elected president for a 7-year term. Chun might not have been popular, but he had the apparent blessing of the U.S., partly because of its willingness to tolerate another brutal military strongman as long as he was anti-communist. Thus, the rise of Chun led to the rise of anti-Americanism in South Korea. But the Americans found him as charmless and unappealing as most of his fellow citizens did, and kept a frosty distance while quietly supporting the democratic opposition. The Fifth Republic, the Last Dictator. Chun Doo-hwan's period in power from 1980 to 1988 was in many respects a continuation of the Park Chung-hee era. While it was a different military clique, it held the same policies, and the same technocrats were drawing up and implementing plans. There were some similarities between the two leaders. Chun, like Park, came from a poor rural background and had chosen a military career as a way out of poverty. Once in power, he focused on economic development, listening to his experts as he did so. Yet there were differences. Park was not a lovable character, but he was respected by many. Chun, by contrast, was viewed with contempt by the majority of the public. The bloody way he seized power, the stain of the Gwangju incident, the personal corruption associated with his wife and his in-laws, and his complete lack of personal charisma contributed to this. He was mockingly dismissed as an octopus-headed thug in private. Octopus-headed was a reference to his baldness. He was the butt of jokes, also told in private, of course, making him appear ignorant and stupid. Most of all, his administration was resented by many citizens who were tired of military rule and the restrictions on their personal freedom, and who had felt robbed of the chance to select a new leader on their own in 1980. Chun attempted to overcome this resentment with token gestures of liberalization. The nightly curfew and the ritual of standing at attention at 5 p.m. ended. School kids no longer had to wear military uniforms, and censorship eased up a bit. By the mid-1980s, most banned politicians were allowed to return to public life, and semi-free assembly elections were permitted. Chun's administration scored many successes. It won the bid for the Olympics, and the economy hummed along quite nicely after 1981. Yet his administration was not popular, and political unrest gradually grew. Then South Korea underwent another transformation, one that took place with the same unexpected swiftness of its economic transformation. It became a democracy.